Zero. Hi, and welcome to episode 82 of Fresh Out of Tokens podcast. This is Tanya, also known as Cypher of Tier, and off to the greater northwest of me, both virtually and literally, is David. Hello, David.
Hello. How's it going?
Not bad. Recovering from a first convention of the year. So, I am here. I'm ready to chat with our amazing guest.
We do have a great guest. I can't wait to get into it.
Yeah, and I'm really excited because this has taken far, far too long to get our guest on the show. So, hi, Quinn. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
Good. I'm excited to have you on. And like I said, it's taken far too long for this to happen. So I'm glad you could make time to hang out with us tonight.
Anytime.
So before we get into all of our questions for you, and I'm sure what will be a really good discussion about tabletop, let's get our intro out of the way. For those that are listening, we have teas and other items in the I Need Diverse Games spreadsheet shop, where we split the profits 50-50 with our friend Chachi Bobings, who did our header and logo. We have a blog to compliment the show, so follow us at outoftokenscast.com. If you have questions, compliments, episode, or guest feedback, or would like to be a guest in the future, drop us a line there in the comments, or follow us on Twitter at outoftokenscast, or email us at freshoutoftokens@gmail.com. Musical accompaniment for our shows is provided by Mike Moody. You can hear more of her work at soundcloud.com/MikeMoody-1. And with the usual admin spiel out of the way, welcome Quinn Murphy. I'm very happy you are here.
I'm happy to be here. So, yeah, it's just good to be on.
So I know who you are because I followed your work and followed you and had the chance to virtually meet you, not yet in person. So for those listening, can you give...
Well, we met at PAX.
Oh, that's right. Wait, which PAX? Because I went to two last year.
PAX East, but it was like brief. Like, we didn't get enough time there. So we'll have to do better next time, but...
So we have to do better this year.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Because I'll be going back to PAX East this year, which was a last-minute decision. But hey, why not? See, this is what happens when you travel as much as I do. And it's not all fun travel, it's work. But for those who have not yet had the pleasure of knowing your work and or you, can you give folks listening a little bit of background?
Oh, man. Well, you know, I've been... For in this context, I do some freelance writing on about different games. I am a writer on dailymtg.com for the last year or so, and writing about just different topics on Magic: The Gathering. I've written an article. Austin Walker had me write one last year on Giant Bomb. And I'm looking to hopefully to do some more, and maybe I have to contact Austin. I might probably do some more for Waypoint. I also have done blogging for multiple years. I ran a blog for a few years based on 4th edition D&D called At Will. And we were known for doing stuff for skill challenges and just a bunch of fun stuff with the rules and lots of different perspectives that were maybe counterintuitive, but until we explained them, and hopefully they were intuitive after that. And now I write the blog ThoughtCrime Games.net, and where I just talk about RPGs, my self-invented term, social fiction, which is just basically like a type of RPG, really. And I design my own games. I've written RPG material for Margaret Weiss Productions, Kobold Press, Wizards of the Coast, and a bunch of other places that I'm probably forgetting right now. So I've been active in RPG design and blogging and thinging for about, a decade or so now.
Awesome.
Oh, and I'm also a semi-professional loudmouth on Twitter. You can follow me on Twitter, but don't be surprised if your timeline gets flooded some mornings, because I've got some thoughts that I'm going to track down.
That's okay. I do the same thing when I can't sleep, so I can't say anything.
So how did this start? The RPGs, not Twitter. What's your origin story?
My origin story and I'm sure probably a lot of listeners have a similar one, is my brother used to play, like, back in D&D's heyday, my brother had the old beige books. He had chainmail and, you know, the original D&D books. He had the advanced D&D books. And, you know, he was playing it around that time, and I was about, you know, five before I started noticing. I was like, what are you guys doing? You know, him and a bunch of his friends were sitting in the house doing this stuff, rolling dice. He had all these weird-looking figures. I was like, what are you guys doing? And they were like, hey, no, get out. You know, not here for you. Which, of course, anytime you kick your younger brother out, he becomes intensely curious about what you're doing. But it was many years where I couldn't even be involved with it. And then I was about 11. And my brother had been moved on. My brother's 7 years older than me. So he was 18. He was, you know, discovering the beauty of, you know, relationships and college and, like, all of this other stuff. So whilst he basically by default left me his books. And so I was just like, hey, I can read these things. And you don't protect them anymore. So I grabbed them and read them, and I wanted to run it. And so I did. You know, I got every rule wrong. I'm sure every rule wrong, but I was hooked, and it's just extended from there. And we didn't even have all the books. I played D&D for advanced D&D for about a year with no DM's guide. So I had to actually reverse engineer a lot of the rules from what were implied from the player's handbook and the monster manual and the theme folio. So that is probably the single biggest thing that makes me a game designer, because I had to do it to play it. Right? Like, I had to make rules to fill in the gaps to play it.
Okay.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Well, you sort of answered what I was going to ask next, but I'm curious as to... Okay, and this may sound silly, and feel free to yell at me if this is a stupid question, but... why didn't you just get a GM guide?
Well, the weird thing, it's so weird to think of it in today's terms, right? Like why wouldn't you just, like, I could just go order it on Amazon.com at the very least, right? But I grew up in, you know, or if I was in the city, I'd just go to a place that had all the stuff, right? But we moved from New York City when I was young, around the time I was in fourth grade, to Western Upstate New York by Buffalo and Rochester. And there is, I spent most of my youth in a small town called Albion. There are no game stores in Albion. Right. And so when I was a kid, I didn't have a car, and there was, the nearest bookstore was in a town called Brockport, about 25-30 minute drive away, that I'd have to have someone drive me to, and they often didn't have the book, and I didn't have a job, so it was sort of like a hard thing to justify, right, at that age, to get. So it just took a long time to make everything line up so I could get the book. Today it would be easy, but then it was very hard to get for me.
It's like you had the epic quest to even learn how to play the game. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if I had to go back, I wouldn't change a thing, because I was so curious about the game and so driven to do something about that thing that really the absence of the GM guide just was, I was like, I'm going to, like, we, you know, in the back in the day, in the Dungeon Master's Guide, that had all the rules for how you got experience points and treasure and everything. And while I was off on a lot of things, I was actually surprised when I finally got it and measured up what things I got right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was actually very encouraging. And then it just made that habit of, well, I could, if I don't like this rule or the way this feels, I can make my own thing. And it just established that habit.
True. So, aside from having to reverse engineer the GM guide for things you were doing, what other factors went into you starting to design games?
You know, I mean, after a while, I was always, well, as I think is kind of typical back in those days, the person who was most motivated to run, to do D&D, to play it, almost always ended up getting being the DM, right? You know, sort of like an enthusiasm hobby. And I was almost always the most enthusiastic to do it, so I ran it to make sure we could do it. And you end up, I feel like every GM is an amateur game designer, right? And you do that for 10 years, say, right? You know, by the time I was in the middle of college, I had these dreams of being a game designer, of making these books. And it took me till really like my late 20s, early 30s to actually start making moves towards it. Like the bug just got so bad where I said, I want to do this. And started pursuing it and started blogging and doing it that way.
Cool. See, for those listening, you don't have to start doing this when you are a wee child. Because I often meet people that think you have to kind of start from a very young age to quote-unquote get anywhere.
Yeah. No, especially not today. I mean, there's so much stuff, like, there's so much stuff to compete with and so much. I don't feel, I feel there's very few game designers who can be really great designers at a young age, right? They're always going to be prodigies, right? And they're just going to break the rules, so I can't really account for them. But for most people, it's going to be really hard to be, you know, I think I'm a much better game designer. I'm like 40 now, and I'm a much better game designer now than I was at 26, than I was at 30, than I was even at 35, right? It's like getting that experience and doing stuff with it.
And I certainly think you're right that every GM is sort of like an amateur game designer. I don't think I've ever played the rules as written with anyone at any point in my life, come to think of it.
It's true. I mean, it's that's the beauty of RPGs. It's why I don't get tired of the medium, really. It's that, like, if I go play, I don't know, Overwatch, I'm obsessed with Overwatch, right? I can think about Overwatch as much as I'd like. And think about what if they did this and what if they did that. But that doesn't change what they actually did to the game, right? Like, my thinking about it doesn't – changing my perspective on the game doesn't do anything. But RPG thinking of, well, hey, if this leads to that, wouldn't that mean this actually changes how I play the game, changes – like, humans are an integral part of a tabletop RPG's rules engine. And then you can extend that even further to try and formalize those perspectives into a set of rules and procedures that do it. And there's no – you don't have to write a graphics engine. You don't have to render a 3D model to make that happen. You can just say, do this, do that, and you've made the like a relevant change. So they're fast to change too.
Very true.
Yeah. And you would know, because you've done some work for RPGs, including Wizards of the Coast. But you're mostly doing your own stuff now. In your experience, is that easier or harder than working for a publisher?
It is both. You know, I've struggled a lot. Like, some game things have taken me longer because I have to render the end product on my own. Right. Like when I work for myself, ultimately I'm trying to make a book. Right. And I've made some decent ones, and like the production is like decent on a few of them, but I'd like to make them better. But then I have to either farm that out or somehow I have to shepherd that to the end. When I worked with a publisher, I just do my best to give them the best, final draft that I can get. Right. And, you know, give them any stuff, maybe an art order or some extra things, and then hand that over. And then I'm done. Right. So it's a lot easier to do it with a publisher. But in a way, it's more satisfying. When I do my own games, I get to do the games that I care about. And I don't have to, I don't even have to really care if there's market viability. I can just say, I think this game is going to be good, and I think there are enough people to care about it that I want to make it, and that's good enough. Where if though a publisher will take care of things, I actually have to satisfy, you know, because they're the reason it's easy for me is because they've hired artists, layout people, the whole thing, and they have this whole production, which means money, which means they have to justify even doing it to break even. So you have to do things for publishers that are going to satisfy their market needs, where when I do my own thing, I just have to try and satisfy myself, and I have a Patreon, satisfy my, you know, patrons, and hopefully they like it, and I'm done. So, you know, it's pros and cons.
Yeah, working for yourself is always a challenge, because it takes discipline, and a lot of people, including myself, have to learn a whole new level of it to get anything done.
Exactly. And then creatively, you have to learn, as we'll probably dovetail into when we start talking about Five Fires, when is enough, and you have to stop being a perfectionist.
I know that pain well. but, you know, since we're on the topic of talking about working for yourself and kind of revamping things, it looks like you've been reworking Five Fires, which, you know, I'm excited about. And every time I mention it to people, they're like, I want this game. So I was wondering, you know, if you could tell people, A, what Five Fires is about, but also if you can tell us, and if you want to, how soon do you think the site will be back up, and what changes have you been making to it?
Yeah, so Five Fires is a game. It's a game about art, but specifically this art is hip hop. And in the kind of default setting of the game, Five Fires has you playing a crew of people in sort of what we'll just call the kind of golden age. Yeah, I'm just going to call it the golden age of hip hop, where sort of where it's kind of past its early infancy, but right into that, you know, that early mid 80s things where people are trying out new stuff, and you make up your own city. Your own fictitious city and crew of people trying to solve problems. You know, like they're normal people trying to solve their problems in their life. You know, trying to get a job, trying to get somebody that they are interested in, fall in love with them, trying to be famous, trying to do all of these things. And but you also have these skills of art, so you might be a great graffiti artist or a break dancer or an MC or a DJ. And art is what sort of helps you along on that end, as you try and solve these problems, you will accumulate stress. And if you get stressed out, it can cause sort of penalties to the things that you want to do. And then art can help you heal that stress, but also art can help you make progress towards that on its own. And it can also grow and sort of change things around you and make you famous or not. And yeah, and that's basically what it's about. It's just a game. I like to think of it as I worked on the idea a few years ago. It's been I've been working on this off and on for 3 years now. It's been too long. It's what made it gel for me as I worked on was I rewatched Beat Street for maybe, I don't know, fifth, sixth time. And it's really Beat Street was what I wanted to be, because that's what Beat Street is. It's normal people who have this ability to make art, and it changes and transforms and helps them out in their lives. And it's basically, you could think of it as Beat Street the game, if you've ever seen it. If you haven't seen it, I suggest you see it.
Very cool. So what changes have you been making to it? Because I saw some of your tweets about kind of of going back and touching it. And
yeah. One of the things that's taken so long is, so Five Fires is a perfect example of something of a project that is dangerous to work on because you care too much about it. And I care a lot about hip hop. I care a ton about hip hop. And when I make a game about this, I'm not trying to make a game that's just like, hey, like it's like D&D, but with like, you know, Run DMC in it. I want to honor the art form. And when you make something like that, though, you want to get it just perfect. Like if there's something off, you want to tweak it just so. So I've been doing a lot of that here and there, some of it mentally, some of it, you know, in writing. My latest revision, this sort of last wave that I'm working on, is really just taking what's there, because I've playtested it. People have playtested it. What's there is actually pretty good. It just needs to be shaped. And I'm just right now trying to shape and make a more directed experience, and make it just things tie in a little more. So there are a lot of small refinements to it that I'm making, rather than the big changes I was planning that aren't really needed in the end.
Those can be killer. Don't let that go on too long.
Right. Yes, it's already been too long for developing. It's between like work and all this other stuff, and then struggling with that. A game like this can sort of sit in your mind in that perfect, like we were talking about earlier, that you know, I need to make this perfect forever, right? If I let it be perfect, then I'll never release it. But I want to release it. Now, I'm hoping to get the site back up and then some of these changes and the sort of release in the next week. So maybe when you guys release this, I don't know when it'll be released, but it might be by the time this one comes out, the site might be up.
Well, week in the strictest term, yeah, then it would be, because this will come out in about 8 days publicly. Yeah, I can certainly understand revisions can get out of hand. I actually have a thing I started working on about 2 years ago, and it's been about 60% there for maybe a year now.
Yeah, I mean, it can be hard. Finishing things is difficult, and I think I alluded it to it earlier. It's the biggest danger of doing things for myself. When I do things for a publisher, I do my best to make something really good, but I know that there's going to be an end point for it. Like, here's the best thing that I can do this time, and then I'm going to give it to you, and then you're going to maybe give me some edits back. And, you know, and I try and to give stuff that, you know, my when I work for someone else, I feel the best thing I can do is give them something that they don't have many edits for, right, to make their job easy. But I'll take their edits, and then I'll fix the edits, and then we're done. But when I do it for myself, it's like I'm the worst editor ever for myself. Right.
Everyone is their own worst editor. It's okay.
Yeah. And, it can make certain projects take forever to get it just so. So that's the real problem I've been having personally as a creator.
And another thing we wanted to ask about actually is you're also working on a Radio Free Kaiju. And would you want to give any of our listeners who aren't familiar, tell them a little bit about what that's about?
Yes, Radio Free Kaiju is, imagine a kaiju film, right? Like big giant monsters, right, in the style of Godzilla and Pacific Rim, where the monsters have actually just won, right? We've tried to do everything we can to get them off the planet, and it hasn't worked. And even to try to nuke them off the planet, we all go underground, all humanity goes underground, and then we just bombard the planet to wipe them out, and all the pretty strong ones are still there, and then they're sort of spawning new ones. And so now humans live underground, because now we can't live really above ground safely, and the monsters kind of rule the world, they rule the skies, they just sort of wander around hitting their agenda, but you know, pursuing whatever it is that they are pursuing. And it's a story game where you can kind of tell stories about humans trying to survive in this weird world. And it takes that premise of the monsters a little further, in that the monsters aren't just there to eat humans, but they actually have, surprisingly, their own agendas that the monsters have, their own motivations. But then obviously the humans are trying to do things too. And in the common setup, they're trying to get from one underground settlement, go above ground to get to the next one, and deal with everything that they see along the way. And it's basically a platform to tell stories within that world setting.
Awesome. I would play that because, you know, I'm always interested in the kind of alternate slash not happy ending of things. So let me know when that is kind of widely available and I would happily play it with you.
Okay, yeah. I should have the newest version of that ready for testing relatively soon, probably in a few weeks. I'm trying to get sort of Five Fires up there, and I've been struggling with, again, this perfectionist streak. I've been struggling with one last bit. So I can finish up the next version of it. But this next version of it should be pretty good.
That's really cool. So, you know, we've talked about a lot of things, and this is kind of relevant to the convention I was just at and other stuff that I'm doing, as well as the work you've done and things that you've said both on Twitter and in your writing on Thought Crime and on your Patreon. But I'm just going to put the elephant in the room out there that we know tabletop has a lot of diversity issues. You know, people think the drow is great representation, and anyone who's listening and thinks that's representation, I've got a short pier for you to take a long walk of, because I feel very strongly about the drow, especially after this weekend. So, you know, I've got my own issues with tabletop. You know, I'm very selective about who I play with or what I play with people, especially at a convention setting. So I was wondering, what have you seen that has pushed you away or kind of made you, you know, treat the larger tabletop community with either kid gloves or kind of like handle with care situations?
So you're saying like, so I just want to make sure I'm getting it right. How should we sort of treat the diversity issue or?
No, more things that have kind of, you know, pushed you maybe away from it.
Ultimately it's, I'm of the opinion that you are what you allow. So if I say I am for LGBT rights, right? But I allow people to say like homophobic, awful kind of things around me and people who are around me without saying anything to them. I'm actually for that because I allow it and I don't stand up against it. And often what happens is, that from what I've seen is that people people talk about diversity and they talk about, you know, hey, let's get everybody in, let's do that. But what they allow are people who try to stamp that out. Every time someone new comes in, they belittle the person, they attack the person, they harass the people, or they direct people to harass the people obliquely so that, you know, they don't get their hands dirty. And I've seen over the years, I've seen person after person driven out of the hobby just because they wanted to design something different, just because they looked at the hobby from a different perspective and tried to see how can we get more people in there? Or isn't this kind of weird, right? They look at something like the drow and they're just like, this is kind of messed up, guys. And people are like, no way, right? And that they're the people who yell at them. But then there are also the people who don't yell at the people who yell. Like they claim to be diverse, right? And they claim to want inclusion, but they don't actually censor the person, the people that chase those people out. And so for me, for the work I'm doing, there's no way that Five Fires, I've never even approached Five Fires to a site like DriveThruRPG or any other normal RPG sites. I just sell it on my own. I'll sell it on my own site. You know, I'll sell it on my own thing. Because why would I subject a game about hip hop and that's going to have like, you know, when I do the art, it's going to be like 80-90% black people, right? Mm-hmm. Why would I subject that game to a group of people who've shown to me, and I've been doing RPGs for 30 something years, right? I've been playing them and designing them and running them for a long time. And that if I can just give a pet peeve, a lot of times when I talk about this stuff, people will be like, well, you don't know what the, you know, like they try and explain to me like as an old hat and I'm like an older hat than most of the people. I've been a, you know, it's going to be a rare person who tells me that they love RPGs more than me, because I've been in it a long time and I've seen a lot of stuff and I've dealt with it and I'm still here and I do it, but I'm not in the mainstream and I don't engage with the big players. Some of them have shown that they are not as good as they appear on the surface, and others just allow this other stuff, which is almost as bad. So I just prefer to stay in my own lane and make stuff and try and engage people there, because the tax is too high, I guess, is a very short version of this. The tax for engagement when you try to do something different is too high.
That makes total sense, and I get it. And that sums up a lot of why I don't really kind of mess with some tabletop stuff, at least publicly. Mm-hmm. I don't go in stores. Mm-hmm. I deal with a lot of it online. And, you know, even at a convention that, you know, I know the people who put on the convention and they pushed for all the diversity they could, made sure they had a lot of people of color for their guests and everything else. The area it was held in was still majority white folks. Mm-hmm. And judging from questions I got on panels I was on or panels I went to, I'm just like, there's a lot of work to be done with this.
Do you think it can improve? And if so, like, what do you think the tabletop community would need to do?
Try and forgive me, like, my mode these days tends to, like, trend towards verbosity on every answer. You know, I'm going to try and keep it succinct here. ultimately, I think what needs to happen is that we need more creators, people often say, when you don't like it, like when you offer even a mild critique of something, they go, "Well, make your own." So go make your own. Right. And we need minority creators to go make their own. I think it's good that there are people trying to sort of mentor and sort of bring people into the fold. I think that is decent. But my experience with some of that has been not all of it, but some of that has been that you also have to accept their terms. And if they don't really understand it and you're just like, "Well, no, it doesn't work like this," sometimes they just shut the book on you. You need a space for people to make their stuff on their own terms and talk to, there's a community, there's a blurred community, say, and I'm speaking from a Black experience, but we can extend, you know, for whatever group it is that you care about, I would say, do this from that, right? I'm not going to try and talk to some group that I don't belong to on that. But for the Black experience, say, there's a whole blurred community of people waiting to consume that content. Didn't Hidden Figures just blow out the box office? Right? Mm-hmm. People want to see this. People tell you that there's no market for it, but that ain't true. Right? People tell you you need to find a way to fit into this mainstream market, but you don't need to do that. You actually don't need to do that. And part of the step of improving it is for creators to stop being afraid of telling the stories that they want to tell. Just tell the stories and make the games that you want to make. Just make them. And never before in history has it been easier to reach the people that you want to reach. I don't go into the normal things. I mostly reach out through Twitter and my blog. And I've been able to connect to the people who care about the things that I care about. So I think that's how we improve it. We just move ahead without asking for permission.
Yeah, because if we sit around and wait for permission, nothing would happen. We'd still be picking cotton.
So. Right. Yeah, it's like you have to just advance it. And then things will change, right? Like, as you see them change culturally in other areas, it's like people will like, "Oh, well, that's actually pretty good. What are these people into over? Oh, wow, that's actually pretty cool." And then some people will, you know, take their stance on it. And then the other people will be like, "Hey, I want to be in on this." And then you just, in RPGs, I've seen the movement be such that we're trying to convince people that they need to do it. And I think we could probably, in 2017, we can probably be done with that.
Yep. If only I had magic powers. And not of the magical Negro trope type, of actual magic powers. But, you know, since we're talking about, you know, kind of getting in the access and everything else, I was wondering if you had advice specific to people of color who want to get in tabletop, because it can be lonely and or hostile for a hobby slash industry that, you know, is very melanin deficient, to be slightly sarcastic about it.
Now, are you talking from a design end or a play end?
Both.
So from a play end, you know, the lucky thing is, like, a theme, man, if I had something like this when I was a kid, I would just have been so happy. But, like, you can just go online. Like, here, go follow, obviously, Fresh Out of Tokens, you know, and go follow Nerd Gaz Noir, go follow Black Girl Nurse, go follow, like, there's a ton of blurred sites out there, right? Or whatever, you know, again, I'm speaking specifically to my experience, but there's, like, a whole range of these things out there, right? It's not just, it's not just blurs, but there's all other variations of this. Like, go get that, and then you can find people. Like, sometimes the hardest thing is getting into the game and not feeling like you're the other.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so see if you can find a community where you're not the other. Right, like where there are people who share experience or are at least open to your experience, right? It doesn't have to be necessarily from your group directly, but an open group, right? Like you could, you know, if you go, you know, find people on Black Girl Nerds, say, you know, any of the other mentions I've played, or your, you know, follow you on Twitter, right? You'll find people who are adjacent and open to you that won't make you feel like other as a player. And then you can play games online. Be open to playing online. That is another great thing. When you have to play with only people around you, it can be really horrible, right? Because you're stuck on your selection. But when you play online, you have a whole, like, I mean, you basically have a whole world to play with. So you can find the people who want to do the things you want to do and want to treat you how you want to be treated. Design is a lot harder, right? Design is, you know, I mean, I guess you can try and find mentors. There aren't a ton of people of color in the space, but, you know, I would say be a player first, like figure out what it is that you like about RPGs, and about tabletop generally. And if you're already there and you know kind of what you want to do is basically go try and find the people who are into the themes that you want to like. I mean, for me, a path was blogging. I really just wrote the kind of things that I wanted to write until someone sort of took notice. And that's a kind of random scattershot way about it. You could probably be more directive than I was. But tabletop RPGs are not a huge money-making proposition, and likely if you're doing it, you're doing it because you love them a lot. And if you're going to do it for the love, then just, you know, this is kind of on this theme of not looking for permission. It's like you can go get a WordPress blog and just blog, and don't worry about who's reading it. Just write. And design and practice in public, though, in public, where people can find you. Does that answer the question sufficiently?
No, that totally answers it, because I think a lot of it is there are probably people doing a lot of this work, but they're not sharing it or they're not posting it either. Because, I mean, imposter syndrome is a thing across all fields. Thinking, oh, it's not good enough, or and this is a demon I wrestle with, is this person is amazing and brilliant and smart. I could never be as smart as them or as awesome as them. I'm just going to never let this see the light of day.
That's a big thing. But that sharing, you're right, that sharing impulse is, that for me, after having you know, I made tons of things and dreamed of RPG design, like, for literally decades, until one day I was just like, well, let me just put this stuff out there. Sure, nobody, like, the hardest part, too, is when you're sharing stuff, is that literally no one will care, right? Because there's millions of words written on the things. There's all of these games written, you know, being made in the world, right? Likely no one will care whatever you publish, even if you publish the War and Peace of RPGs. No one will care. And that is actually the hardest part, is to write and to create and to design when no one cares anything about you. And eventually, if you can persist and keep shit being public, then that's the key. It's like, you can't write in private and try and be perfect. You have to actually put it out there in a place that people can see. There's a high probability, just through persistence, that someone will find you. And that you can sort of take the next step.
Yep.
Yeah, that's good advice for anybody. Mm-hmm. Speaking of, you know, going out in public, are there any conventions that you'd recommend a POC interested in tabletop attend? Or is convention attendance a good idea for folks looking to get in or do more with it in general?
So the first thing I'm going to recommend is the Metatopia. This is particularly for designers, but also it for, you know, if you're interested in playtesting games. Metatopia is a designer-centric con where designers go to kind of workshop and playtest their games, and then you can go and playtest those games and work with the designers directly and talk with it. It's a really great con. The team is, I believe, Double Exposure is a formal name of it. It's a really great team. They've been really open and really some people, I think we've all experienced things where people talk the talk and fail to walk the walk. Every experience I've had, they've talked the talk and walked even further than they talked. That is a place where I think people will make you. I think it just about anything they run. I've only been to Metatopia, but I hear good things about everything that they run. It's like around the New Jersey area that they run things like Dreamation and other stuff. They are really solid people and dedicated to making a safe space. Then everything else is kind of touchy. You know, it is just like, you know, walking around America. It's you've got to, as a person of color, I feel you've got to make peace with figuring out what it is you want and trying to negotiate people who might just hate you, right? You've got to be able to learn from people who might hate you, you know, who never wanted you to learn from them or read their book. You might have to engage with those people and still extract something that you can use, right? So it's sort of touching in that, like we were talking before the show, Tanya and I, about Gen Con, right? Gen Con is an interesting thing, right? Before I blabber on about it, did you want to say something about that, Tanya? Like sort of like your thoughts on the Gen Con?
Well, I've never been to Gen Con. I got a lot of people this year that are like, so you going to Gen Con? You going to Gen Con? And I'm like, I don't know, because I'm already going to like 8 million other conventions. And though it is convenient, you know, distance-wise for me, all I've ever heard about Gen Con, it is very expensive, very crowded, and this year is a big anniversary year. But I know there are folks working toward getting more diversity and inclusion. I know the industry insider pool was a lot more diverse than, like, in the history of ever last year. So, you know, I try to be hopeful, and I try to give the benefit of the doubt, but that is really hard because look at how long this shift has taken. You know, and having just been a guest of honor at a tabletop-focused convention and still getting people who think it's cute to ask me questions about the drow after I just said, don't fucking ask me about the drow. I'm cautiously optimistic, and that's probably the best I can say, is I have never actually been to a Gen Con event.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been to a few Gen Cons. It's been a few years since I've been to Gen Cons, you know, and it's funny, I'm biased. Like, some people that are like some of my best friends in the industry, people who I really treasure dearly, I met for the first time, like after meeting them online and working with them online. I got to meet in real life for the first time over there. I've had great experiences on a personal level, but then it becomes hard to, you know, for me, the big thing is I think about, hey, I want to bring somebody, like I want to bring another Black person into Gen Con, and I want to like walk around, and then, you know, I'm going to show them, oh, isn't that cool? Isn't that great? Oh, isn't that awesome? And then at some point, I know that I'm, because I've seen it myself, and I, again, 30 years I've been around this, so I just sort of just put blinders on it and just sort of like, okay, whatever, and go about my business. But you see a bunch of people with pointy ears in blackface, and, you know, sometimes bikinis, you know, walking down the strip, right? And then I'm thinking, how am I going to explain that to that person, right? Like, oh, you should really be involved in this, boy, right? And that is the biggest issue to me, right? And that is a kind of thing where people argue for the tradition of drow as opposed to, say, the tradition of blackface. I think that overweighs it. But, you know, it's these cultural kind of things. There's a huge, what some people might not understand is that there is a huge conservative contingent within the tabletop RPG community. And they essentially, because other people don't stand up to them, run it. Mm-hmm. And you know, like they run it by default. Right. And so and like I alluded this to this earlier, and that's why I don't engage, because if no one stands up to these kind of people, then they run it. They rule. Right. And so that's why the drow still like run, like people in blackface and pointy ears still run around Gen Con. So it's hard to like, I think there's lots of great stuff about Gen Con. But I still think it has these real huge issues. Like I want to go again, right? You know, and then there's another whole set of issues why I don't go. But I personally don't know how I reach that, especially like you said, considering the cost. It's expensive, and it can be great, but it can also not be worth it. So
definitely, and we can. Talk about this forever, I'm sure, but I kind of wanted to get back to what you're doing, because you're doing a lot of cool stuff, and I enjoy seeing your progress blogs and your Patreon posts. But I was wondering, aside from Five Fires Revamp and Radio Free Kaiju, you know, kind of what else is cooking for you design wise?
So I've got a No Man's Sky kind of tribute set of micro games called We Are Stardust. Basically it uses like I'm actually working on an open source project that will be the foundation, for making like a little, text generator, scanner thing that will like generate different, planet outputs for you and put it to like, say like a cell phone. And then you use those to do, little, micro games. Like the first one is, We Are Explorers. In there, and then it's sort of you have a planet, and then you tell the story. Like you basically record, like in No Man's Skies, you have you run into the diary entries of the lost travelers as you travel through, where someone's like, "Oh, such and such happened." And so, given this information that you get, you record you sort of record or tell the other players your diary entry. You know, here's what happened to me and here's what was going on. And then there's a lot of other different micro games attached that use the scanner for it. So it's sort of this, there's no dice in the game, and it's a lot of little micro sort of short form story constructs that go to it. So that one is sort of in various stages of development, a lot of programming actually for me. And then the other one that I'm starting to nibble on now is I'm trying to think of the succinct way to describe this. Harlem Freeform LARP. I guess is the best way to do it. And for if people don't know what freeform LARP is, it's a special kind of LARP. LARP is live action role play, so you're sort of embodying the characters rather than just having a character sheet. But it's freeform LARP in particular has more. There's more sort of meta work and sort of this more you can sort of kind of cut and edit and sort of play with it. You're not trying to be real time all the time. And Harlem, it's Harlem. But specifically, I have this theme that I've been chewing on for forever and starting to actually like research and write about. There's this old in during the Harlem Renaissance, there was this place called the Hotel Teresa. And it was basically the hub of – it was one of the main hubs of the Harlem Renaissance. It was this huge hotel where dignitaries came in, all the, like, great black intellectual figures and all of those things. They would come in. They would stay in this hotel. And one of the most famous one of the most famous stories of the Hotel Teresa is – Fidel Castro came in for a UN meeting once, and when he went in there, the hotel made him, because he was from Cuba and I guess he was Castro, they made him prepay because they thought he was going to ditch out the thing. Yeah, can you imagine? Right? And so he was like, hey, you know what? I think I know a place you're going to treat me better. And he went and he snubbed all of the other white-run hotels in New York. And he went to Hotel Teresa, and it was almost like an international incident.
Wow.
And so one of the things I want to lead up to that, I want to kind of make a triptych of short freeform LARPs, but in these LARPs, I want to sort of set them up so the people are playing the people who work in the Hotel Teresa and they're dealing with their own problems. Whether trying to deal with these great events, I mean, because, you know, Langston Hughes and, you know, like every, you know, name a great figure through the Harlem Renaissance, they were likely at some point in the Hotel Teresa doing something. And whether it's fictionalized or real, I want to sort of make them deal with the history and then their own personal lives in this sort of freeform LARP kind of thing. That's sort of my next big thing, and sort of make a triptych of those concluding with that Fidel Castro one. So you play these characters and you go through their themes, and then you have to deal with this crazy stuff where like Castro's in your hotel and things are going crazy.
That's so cool.
That sounds like an excellent setting, honestly. Yeah, I will be very interested to hear about what comes of this. So, is there anything else new and exciting coming up for you? Do you have any other plans that you want to mention?
I mentioned that I'm working on the site. I'll be doing more blogging there. I had kind of gotten frozen up in my blogging for a while with all the events in American society and other things going on. But I've been doing more blogging lately. I've been obsessed with anime, so I'm writing more stuff about anime-based storytelling. I released a little while ago a last year blog post called Hyper Emotion, which talked about sort of how emotions, how a lot of anime is actually about communities of actors and feelers and their interplay, right? Like the feelers make life worth living and the actors are able to change the world, right? I mentioned sort of the Krillin effect in there, right? Like why does Krillin exist in Dragon Ball Z after a certain point, right? He can't do anything. He can't fight anybody. He's functionally useless. He's not an actor, but through Krillin's perspective, through Krillin's friendship, it is what one of the main things that motivates Goku to take action to protect the world, right? Krillin makes Goku's life worth living, and Goku can change the universe, right? So Krillin is as important as Goku. Like, without Krillin, Goku might not even be – like, you know, without – you know, Goku has family and stuff like that. But, like, you know, without those attachments, Goku is just a god, right? And why does he care except to just fight and, like, blow up the whole thing? So, like, why doesn't he blow up the Earth every time he fights? Because he has people he cares about, those sealers, right? And then I have a follow-up to that that I'm writing right now called Mega Seconds, which talks about sort of the expansion of time. And all of these things sort of relate obliquely to RPG things. You can sort of use the concepts, I think, in tabletop games that you're running. So, but it's sort of it's a little high-minded, I guess, but hopefully I think it can fit and work with what people do in their home games.
Awesome. So I know we've been chatting for a bit, but this came up during our pre-recording chat, and I think it's relevant to the conversation we've been having, as well as things that I would like to see die in a fire in tabletop. You know, and I don't say this lightly because I don't believe in using trigger as a joke or anything else, but mention of drow and the justifications people will tie themselves up in knots to have them in the game or be racist or wear blackface is reaching a point where it is turning into a trigger for violence for me. And I don't say that to be funny, because anyone who's ever met me or seen me on a panel knows that I really don't have a sense of humor about this. But you were talking about an article you wrote that reimagined the drow, even going so far as changing it from D-R-O-W to D-R-A-U. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the article and kind of where the impetus came from to do that. And I'm very glad that you did it. Whenever I run D&D again or play D&D, I'm going to be like, if there are any drow in this game, this is what we're doing. If you can't be okay with this, then I'm leaving.
It's funny. That has actually been – that has been one of the most surprising things. Like when I wrote – but just about anything that I write for myself is just to scratch my own itches and like hopefully – luckily for me, a lot of things that I use to scratch my own itches, like also, like there are a bunch of other people going, yes, that scratched my own. And so I was really surprised and like pleasantly that a lot of people, like people have told me like, this is how we do drow in my campaign now, right? Like we just don't even acknowledge the old way. And these are what drow are. And essentially, so the drow, D-R-A-U, in this, and I do that purposely to denote that they are meant to be something different, not just to be oblique, but you know, and sort of contrary, but to say like, hey, no, this is like a separate thing. And in this, so there are lots of cool thing about the drow, right? And there's lots of crap about the drow. And people tell you that in order to get the good stuff about the drow, you have to keep the crap about the drow because tradition, which is would almost be understandable, except the drow are completely fictional. There's no real world. There's no real world culture to the drow, right? Like if you said they were, you know, hey, this is like this culture X Y Z, and like they did this and they did that, and you're like, well, you know, that I guess that is true, right? You know, and it would still be icky, but you were like, well, at least it is. There's some rationale, but drow are completely fictional. They're completely made up. There's some mythology that they're tied into, but how they're rendered in D&D, that tradition is not a tradition that we have to honor because there are no real people tied to them, right? And so we can just take the crap out of it. Like the evil elves, like they make elves as pale as possible, like the good elves as pale as possible, as white as possible, and the bad elves are as black, like they're pitch black or like deep purple. That's kind of crazy, right? And you don't have to actually do that, especially because they live underground. They live in the dark. So they're dark and have dark skin. That doesn't work, right? It's not even real. You know, people try and say tradition or like realism, but that's not even realistic. Like if they lived in caves, they'd actually be like albinos. Right? Like they'd have no, like they wouldn't be tan, right? And they certainly wouldn't be pitch black, right? So I just took all of that out of it and tried to reimagine them as something that has all the fun stuff that, like, I think what people like about the drow are the mystery, are the, like, drow defy simple good and evil. Traditionally, they sort of work to their own ends, right? and you know, they can be sort of traitorous or loyal. And then I took out the blackface and the evil matriarchs, right? And it was actually kind of easy, you know, and I wish more people would confront fantasy in that way. Sorry, that was like a long diatribe on that.
That's okay. You didn't hear how much I cussed this weekend every time the word drow came up. Frankly, I don't care. I'm going to be an asshole in this moment. And I kind of tweeted post-panel with the person who decided that instead of actually listening to the entire panel I had just done with a couple folks, friends of mine who work at Paizo, Crystal and Jessica, about not having racist players and what to do as a GM and or player if someone's an asshole at the table, they decided, after all of that, that they would ask, but what if somebody wants to be a racist drow? And I'm just like, I'm going to leap over this table right now. And so, you know, bless Crystal. She had a legit, I'll hold your flower, baby, moment, because look, whatever look I got on my face, she was just like, I'll hold your laptop, it'll be okay. Just go do what you gotta go do. Well, because someone else in the audience thought they'd be cute and asked me how you pronounce it, drow or dro, and I'm like, you are so not funny. But I also had that look. You know that look that your mom has when she's about 2 seconds from giving you a whooping?
Mm-hmm.
I must have had that look or something similar, because she's like, "I just go. I got your laptop. We'll be okay." But I think my final moment of fuck this, I quit, I'm out, I'm going to the bar, was someone in my Twitter mentions after I talked about this experience and also live tweeted the D&D and diversity panel, was claiming that the drow were based on Italians.
That's completely crap.
There's you know, enough. Italians were subterranean.
That's right. Like, I remember all those things where the Italians were in caves. No, it's not a like drow are made up, right? Like, they're, you know, and that is one of the problems with conservative fandom, is that they stand behind they try and treat fake cultures as worth more than real cultures, and then, but again, in that thing where they're allowed to posit that, right? So there's one thing where these people say that to them, but like say that stuff to you. But why don't people? And I'm not trying to put everyone on the spot here, but I think it's worth thinking about. Why don't people just collectively go, "What the hell?" Right? Like, shut up. Right. And like why does everybody around someone, when they say something like that, like the drows are based on Italian, go, no, they're not. You're stupid. Right. And we're not listening to anymore. Moving on. Right. Like, that's an option, but people don't take it. And so that becomes center field.
Yeah. And, you know, I have my moment because I hate when people do it to me, but I'm like, I'm going to be a jackass. I was like, citation needed for this cool story, and walked away. And they actually came back with an article they thought justified it. And I'm like, I'm done. I'm going somewhere that is not anywhere near Twitter. But while we're talking about questions, we have good questions for you. You know, nothing like what I get on Twitter most days ending in Y. And since I've talked quite a bit and ranted and yelled, and I'm sorry, listeners, but that was not going to stay inside once we start talking about the trial. But David, why don't you take our first question from our friend and family at this point, Tim.
Hey, Tim.
All right. Tim's first question is, which of your games do you think plays best for a group that has little to no pen and paper experience?
Ooh, that's a good one. I think, so I made a game, one of my first, like, solo, completely for myself games is called Community Radio. And it's sort of based on, it takes inspiration from, like, Night Vale and Northern Exposure, these things where it's sort of a small town with a very influential sort of radio presence, but it's also kind of weird and creepy. And it uses a lot of Mad Libs to kind of drive the scenes is very improv based. There are no character sheets. There's no you can start playing it, in basically five minutes. Just start doing stuff, and you're telling like little stories, and then someone puts on a broadcast, and you sort of alter back and forth between these playing out these skits and these sort of mock radio broadcasts. And it can take sometimes people a little, like the maybe first playthroughs can be a little hard because people are used to just making up stuff there. But once you start and you get those first one or two out of the way, it tends to just flow. And there's just no other system for them to get, so it doesn't get in their way.
Awesome. Continuing on with questions about your games, Tim's next question is, what's one of the most memorable experiences you've had seeing other people playtest your games?
I think the first playtest of Metatopia, or the first place of Five Fires at Metatopia, was pretty amazing. I had a good group of people who were really psyched about it, and it was just, I hadn't even had some of the major pieces down, but there was a lot of great energy, a lot of great feedback. And, I mean, it's the best thing is when you, for me, the best thing when you play test a game is when you see. So there's one thrill that you see a thing that you thought was going to work actually work. That's like that's a tightrope thing. Like, oh my God, it actually works. Like I can walk across this. I'll live. Right. And that feels great. But then there's this thing that does something completely unexpected. There's this sort of emergent quality of that. Like when it meets someone who's not you and they look at it and they're like, oh, you could do this. And you realize that, yeah, that's actually in there. I didn't intend for it to do that, but it did that. And so there's a downside of it when somebody finds something that you didn't want, like that you didn't intend to be in there, that's actually bad and sort of kind of makes the game go down. But when people find things that are actually even better than you thought they would be, that is the best thing. And we found a lot of stuff in that initial Metatopia playtest that was just awesome and guided a lot of the rest of the development.
Very cool. What is and Tim's third question is, what is your favorite generation of Magic the Gathering, and do you play Magic with family?
So I don't play much Magic with family. I play no Magic with family. My son is still too young to really play Magic right now. He's five. He'll be six in June. I'm trying to get him. I am getting him hooked on Pokemon right now. And then I will upgrade him to Magic later. And my wife's not really all that enamored with Magic. Fair. My favorite generation of Magic. I'm almost a bad person to ask because I'm just a huge fan of Magic. I write for Magic, but I feel like I write for Magic because I love Magic so much, right? Like I'm really, I've always loved it for the past 20 plus years. But I'd have to say, if the generation of Magic, the one that has its imprint deepest on me, is the generation of Magic right around the first Pro Tour. Because like a lot of what influences Neon Magic is actually the writing about Magic. There's a lot of, and this might seem weird to people who don't really play Magic or follow it deeply, but Magic has a ton of great theory strategy articles. Not just here's the best deck, but like here is why the best decks are good. And there's a seminal text called The Schools of Magic that kind of breaks down these schools of thought on it, and it was like the first big memory and first big theory article, and it happened around the time of the first Pro Tour, and you know, you had all these cards that they would never print now, like Armageddon and Black Vice, and cards that were just too busted. But it all sort of tied together, and that era of Magic has a deep imprint on me as a. It's one of the things that shaped me as a game designer, as a game player, and sort of like my strategy, and then as a fan of the game. So I guess that would be around then.
Well, I actually should find a way to get you some Magic cards, because I got some as part of my swag at OrcaCon, and I'm like, these are pretty, but I don't know what to do with them.
Well, we'll have to play at some point. Like if we meet up at PAX East, I'll show you Magic. We'll play.
Okay.
And then you can do something with them.
Okay, because I'm just like, they're lovely. I have no clue what these stats mean. And speaking of playing games, you have listened to the show and I've rambled at you about the show previously. Way we kind of wind down and start to wrap up is talking about what we've been playing. And as you are a guest, you get to go first. And you've also probably been playing more games than either one of us combined, because I've not been home. So go for it. What's been hopping with you game wise?
Overwatch. So I explicitly, like, people were like, so I watched the beta of Overwatch and I said, oh man. So I'm a huge Blizzard fanboy. I think they are, in terms of their legacy, the best video game company ever. Like they make games that, like, with lifespans of like 5-10 years, which is unheard of, right? Because they balance them so well and pay so much attention to them. And so I was looking at Overwatch and was like, wow, this game looks really great. And I normally hate first person shooters. I can't really get into, like, I haven't played anything deeply since like Shadowrun, say. But I was like, this one looks great. And everybody told me to get it. And I was like, no, I have stuff to do. So I'm not going to play. I explicitly did not play Overwatch. Around the winter, around late November, I was like, okay, I need something to do. I need to, like, chill out, relax. I need to, like, get into this thing. I'm going to try this Overwatch game now. Worst thing I ever did. I'm so obsessed with this game. Overwatch is so good. It is so good, and I can't stop playing. And then I'm also playing Dragon Ball Xenoverse 2. I just got that, like, maybe a night or two ago. And that one happened because I was showing my wife stuff that I animated that I was into when I was a kid. But I didn't want to show her the full Dragon Ball with all the filler. And, you know, that takes 10 episodes to do anything. So I showed her Dragon Ball Z Kai. And then I ended up watching a bunch of it, and then I was obsessed with it. So then I got Dragon Ball Xenoverse 2, so I could play Dragon Ball after watching it. And then the last one is Android Assault Cactus. It's like a twin stick shooter. It's like a twin stick shooter. It's like Smash TV meets a Japanese shmup, sort of like a bullet hell shmup. It's really fun and bite-sized, so I, like, play it in between games. Like, when I just sort of want a palate cleanse, you can play, like, a round in a minute or two, and it's really fun and addictive. So those are my three in rotation.
Very cool. David, what have you been playing?
I've mostly still just been messing with Endless Sky, and I have managed to play a little bit of Fallout 4. I like built a retirement home on top of a gas station. Only old people have shown up, so I assume it's a retirement home at this point. One of the old people accused another of being a secret robot, and they were right. I told them they were crazy, but it turned out they were a secret robot. So I did think of something earlier, which pertains to both of these, though, which is that you mentioned earlier how with a video game, everything seems a bit more, like, solid. But These are both like highly moddable games, and I think mods are sort of like the video game equivalent of like a house rule.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could see that. And you know, the only difference between them is that speed of execution is. And the funny thing is, the mods are great because they train people in the craft of development of sort of like, hey, I have this idea, how do I make it real? And then you have to at some point go learn how to like, you know, model a thing in 3D or like do some scripting. So they sort of like bring this other end. They don't directly translate, almost directly translate like tabletop RPG rules do, but they're still really awesome in that way of that, you know, I know people who got into game development just from modding stuff all the time. And they're like, oh, I can actually just make games now.
I do feel like Bethesda like uses modders as a safety net. Uh-huh. Because you can't like their construction thing that they're wild about has no interior door frames unless you use mods.
Oh, that's weird. Yeah, I haven't played the Bethesda's game on a moddable platform. Like normally, I would play them on PS4, so I haven't experienced that. But that's interesting.
But speaking of the Tanya, do you want to talk about what you've been playing?
I've gone back to the Elder Scrolls Skyrim Special Edition because why not? For anyone who's not heard me say this, I've never actually completed a whole playthrough of Skyrim. And I've gotten further than I ever have before in this game. But today was kind of a lot of amusement because I went to fight the dragon that you summon when you get the Elder Scroll in Skyrim, except I didn't know the dragon was going to show up. So, silly me, does the dragon thing, learns the shout, and suddenly Alduin appears, which I was not ready for. There was a whole lot of cussing and running, much like me in the Aeroshock fight in Dragon Age 2, and then I was like, you know what, this was a bad life choice, I'm just gonna reload, I'll come back to this later. So yeah, that's me, because that's all I've had time to play, because I've not been home for the last week.
Do you ever play like do you have like a portable? Do you ever like just sort of like run like a DS or Vita or something on the go?
I actually just got a Nintendo 3DS from a friend of mine who was very kind because I was tweeting about wanting to kind of splurge on one, and they were like, "Oh, well, I've got one and I don't use it because you know like, I'm getting that message a lot from people where they bought it and then it was like I don't actually use this thing." So they sent it to me and left all their games installed. So now I've got that. And it uses the older cartridges I still had. So me and Final Fantasy IV and the Gandalf gif of legit, why am I on this island? Where's the airship taking me? That is me right now with the 3DS.
Nice. At some point, we'll have to... Excuse me. One of my favorite games on the 3DS... is Monster Hunter. One of my favorite Nintendo games is Monster Hunter. And have you played Monster Hunter?
I played a little bit before I got rid of my Wii U because Chris talked me into it, our friend Chris. Yep. And played it. And it's one of those things where if your friends are not around to play it, it's kind of boring, at least for me.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a better group game.
So yeah, that's what I've been doing. Hopefully I can catch up with some game playing because Read-Only Memories 2064... the new version with voice acting just came out today, the day we're recording this. So hoping to get in some of that before we record again. But sadly, that also brings us to the end of the episode and this amazing chat with you. And I'm sad to see you go, but you know you can always come back and talk to us.
I would love that.
Yes. So, you know, you've always got a spot here with us at Fresh Out of Token, especially as you get more stuff done on Five Fires and Radio Free Kaiju, because I would totally love to hear more about it. I know where to find you, so I was wondering if you could let folks listening know where to find you online and the best way to kind of hear about what you are doing.
Sure. So I always like to lead out with my Twitter and my disclaimer. So I'm QH_Murphy on Twitter. Warning, I don't know how to use Twitter. I really don't know. Like, it's not a joke. I don't know how to use Twitter. I often go on like 20 plus tweet storm rants about some politics or game design or whatever. I do my best to thread them, but they might clog your timeline. Some people are cool with this. Thank you for those people. Some people, that's not what they want on Twitter. So I like to put that disclaimer out there when I give that one, but I try and keep it interesting, right? I don't just go and like Instagram all my food or something and, you know, here's what I ate today for 20 tweets in a row. Like when I have something to say, I'll say it in as many tweets as possible, I guess. but I'm also on Patreon, patreon.com/Quinn. This is one of the joys of early adoption there. You get to just use your first name. And then my blog is thoughtcrimegames.net. And I have lots of stuff there. I talk about social fiction, which is, again, this term that I use to describe a certain type of tabletop RPG, but then also just all sorts of other stuff. My latest is actually about why you should be focusing on your art in this weird age of Trump more than ever. So that might be worth a read. And those are the main places.
Awesome. Well, I mean, I follow you. I know where you are. But the folks that have listened to the entire podcast and want to know more about your work should definitely go follow you. And you know what? 6 a.m. Twitter threads are what life is all about, so deal with it. Great, great quality content. So, and those Twitter threads are always like real, real good stuff. So I say follow Quinn, but that's me. I'm biased. David, where can folks find you?
I can be found on Twitter as @RedConversation. I have a Patreon, which is patreon.com/RedConversation. I can be found at davidrreeves.com. which is a very poorly constructed website for my editing services. And that's basically it. Tanya, where can people find you?
I'm pretty much Cipher of Tear everywhere. Twitter, Tumblr, not Facebook, because my Facebook is locked, but if you find me on Facebook, I have a public page for the stuff that I am doing. And CipherofTear.com is my site where I talk about various things. On occasion, put together those long strings of tweets when I can't sleep at 5 a.m. Chicago time. And, you know, talk about conventions I'm doing, talks I'm doing. And I have a Patreon, which keeps a roof over my head right now because I do not have a day job. This is part of what I do. But also, we have a Patreon for I Need Diverse Games that keeps this show on the air. So if you're listening and like the show, whether you're a longtime listener or first time listener because of our amazing guest, as little as $1 will help us stay on the air, and it will get you early access to episodes before everyone else gets them on Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central. And with that, we're done, sadly. But, you know, we'll get Quinn back at some point. And, you know, if we get a chance to run amok at PAX East, we can maybe record a quick snippet there. So that's it for this week. We will see you next week. Avanel Wing of the Credit Bureau and also involved in tabletop and a bunch of other cool stuff will be joining us next week before I run away to Ord Camp, which is a local event for me. So thank you again, Quinn, and we will talk to you all in a week. Bye.
Bye.
All right.
And I'm hitting stop.
Stop.
Okay, so let me make a folder. We'll be right back.